So, I come back to our five faculties, the Indriyas, and there was one question left over from yesterday, which I remember, which was asking about Sampajanya. The question about what precisely is Sampajanya, what that means. I was talking about Sati Sampajanya and Sampajanya being an element that needs to be there that contributes to defining sati mindfulness as right mindfulness. And it also, I think, fits together with the question that came here this morning in the chat, whether I could say a few words more about the right mindfulness versus bank robber mindfulness. Sampajanya might have something to do with it. So sampajanya actually is a Pali word, and it comes from a verb, which is sampajanati. And pajanati means he or she knows. So it's about knowing. It's a basic, again, another basic kind of mental faculty of just knowing. And sam is in Pali, it's often as a prefix, like with sampajanya, is usually an intensifier. I think it's probably similar, like this, for example, with sati or samasati. I'm not a Pali scholar, but they also have got the sam in there, and it's often like it's often translated either as right mindfulness, but also as complete mindfulness or something like that. So anyway, if you have sampajanati, that verb, and sampajanya is derived from that, then it means this clear knowledge. That's all the usual translation, clear knowledge or clear comprehension. And I think it's quite it's probably quite accurate, good translation. So whereas sati, as I said, just denotes the quality of being present with whatever is at hand. It could be with anything, but like what we would translate as saying, like to be not, as I said, it was non-distraction, isn't it? That's what defines sati, non-distraction. So you are with what you're doing. Like our cooks who are preparing the meal today, when they're chopping vegetables, then hopefully they're going to have sati. That means they're actually present when they cut the vegetables and not distracted, say in conversation. So to avoid cutting into your fingers. No, otherwise, if you're not present with what you're doing, then your part of your finger might end up in the salad or something, which wouldn't be very good. So that's sati. So this is really just an intentional quality. No? So non-distractiveness. That's why this is part of the samadhi section in the path, sati. No? So sampajanya adds the knowing quality. So whereas sati means to be with what you're doing, sampajanya means to know what you are doing, to clearly know what you're doing. No? So in some ways, that's very handy, clear definition, isn't it? Like when we ask somebody, or some weekend, if somebody doesn't have any sati, we might say, where are you? You're all over the place. No? Then when somebody doesn't have any sati. Or we would say somebody you wanna like, what are you doing? No, you don't know what you are doing. You might be very focused, very present, but actually what you're doing might be completely inappropriate or something. No. So then you would say you don't know what you're doing. No. But this quality then of sampajanya is not further kind of very clearly defined in the suttas itself. You can derive kind of the range of what it might mean from the context, because it appears in all kinds of different contexts in the suttas. And you can see from there, it can mean from very basic, just knowing what's going on, to a very evolved conceptual discernment, like in the question was suggested, like knowing of the Four Noble Truths. It can cover this whole kind of range. So if you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, it's usually tied to very simple activities, like this continuing kind of pattern that appears in the suttas. Like if you're breathing in long, you know that you're breathing in long. No, this that you know that you're breathing in long, that's due to sampajanya. So you need both. You need the sati to actually be with the breath, otherwise you won't know, of course. But then also you're not mindlessly being with your breath. You also know that it has this reflective element. No, and so that's a very basic knowledge, no, and that's just the kernel from which, when it is kind of developed, it can kind of go into full-blown wisdom. So it's basically the seed of wisdom, this basic mental faculty that we all have, which is the be now. But this knowing, of course, really only becomes fruitful for us, particularly in the practice, when it's combined with sati, when we actually, you know, when we apply it to what's actually happening. You know, if my knowing is in the clouds and I'm not visit, it cannot work. It cannot go to work. So that's why those two become very powerful when they come together. Ajahn Buddhadasa, for example, he calls this, he translated this as wisdom in action. You know, it's kind of applied wisdom. I think it's the same, like, to go outside of the tradition, again, Krishnamurti, he talks a lot about the natural intelligence. You know, this fact that our mind is naturally intelligent. But for this intelligence to go to work, we're going to have to apply to something. You know? And so that's what we need to be with what we are doing, so that that intelligence can actually connect to the task at hand, right? So Sampajanya then can cover a whole range of things, and is obviously very, very important for meditation. Because mindfulness just means you're present, you're paying attention. So all what mindfulness does, it gives you information. No? And then Sampajanya is what processes that information with intelligence. Now, if you're very mindful, that's what I'm saying, you know, mindlessly being with the breath, you've heard, you learned the technique or something, and then you just keep doing this, you might get very good at being with the breath. But if you don't process, you know, the information that, that mindfulness gives you, what use is it going to be to you? It's probably very, very limited, you know, if you don't use your intelligence. Okay, so that's why, for example, Ajahn Chah, I think in one of his discourses, talks about even a cat's got a lot of sati. A cat can have a lot of sati when it sits in front of the hole and it's waiting for the mouse. You know? It means there you see how sati is, also has this concentration quality, you know, the cat is really focused and it really pays attention. You know? And as soon as there's movement, it pounces. But we can conjecture, at least, of course, we don't really know because we are not cats, but that the Sampajanya of the cat is fairly limited. No, of course, also cats also got its intelligence. The knowing that the cat uses is just a range for it. It's just very limited to its task, isn't it, to catch the mouse, you know, catch something. No. There's, of course, our potential for knowing Sampajanya is potentially vast, isn't it? So they can look at sati sampajanya in different contexts. So it also explains that just to have sampajanya with it by itself, by definition, doesn't define sati as necessarily as samasati or right mindfulness, according to the Buddha. Because also our bank robber, to talk about bank robber mindfulness, he also, of course, needs to apply sampajanya, some clear comprehension. Means that what the clear comprehension does for him or for her is that it's not just focused on the job, but sampajanya, the intelligence of the mind, would relate all the information what you pick up to what's actually the intention, what's the plan, and so therefore then come up with the appropriate response. No. Like depending what kind of bank robber you are, let's say also this paint this image, you know, you are in there, you're this, I'm thinking of this classical kind of gentleman thief, you know, was very skilled at opening safes, and it's got all her tools there, and it's got the plan. But it's really kind of a gentleman or gentlewoman thief wouldn't at all be inclined to violence. No, it's really focused on the job and listening into the sound of the, you know. And so also there's a lot of sati, and there's always there's intelligence also working. You know, a good bank robber is will need some intelligence, so knows what's happening. Then suddenly there's a sound from the back room, no? And so with sati, of course, it would have, hopefully it's not so concentrated that the bank robber doesn't hear anything. So sati usually is just focused on the present, but it can have a range. That's, it's not necessarily concentration on an object. If you get too concentrated on the object, you don't even hear that the security personnel is coming from the back room or something, no? But a sati can be more open. You're just very focused on the present, but it takes in everything that's relevant. You know, so the ears are open, you know, like a bat, you know, and then there comes the sound. And so the intelligence, the sampajanya, relates, processes that information intelligently. So it just knows that, well, this is relevant. Just don't ignore this. And this has to do with my plan. I'm going to have to come up with a response because this might be the security personnel. So you've got plan B, how to escape as quick as possible without leaving any traces so you don't get caught. No? So that is Sati Sampajanyan operation for the successful bank robber. No? Yeah, of course, it doesn't make the activity wholesome. No, as long as it's confined to just the job of the bank robber. Would be different if it's a bank robber who isn't so gentlemanly and is quite happy to also apply violence. No, it might be exactly the same situation, same mindfulness, same job, same activity, but the plan is a different one. No, so the idea or the view with which you come into the present is different. So this bank robber hears the sound, notices it, notices the relevance, relates it intelligently to his plan. And if he's violent, then it's probably a man, so it's a male bank robber. And so then wouldn't just come with a plan B running away, but just would pick up a tool or something and hide behind the door. And when the guard comes in, then bang, one over the head, isn't it? It's a different plan. Like this again, Sati Sampajanya in operation in the context of a violent bank robber. It's even less wholesome. What makes our mindfulness right mindfulness then is the context. It's a view. That's why the Buddha was always pointing out that right view is fundamental. No, it's not a fundamentalist, just thinking fundamental. It's not a fundamentalist kind of approach to right view. Like if you're not Buddhist, if you don't believe in the Four Noble Truths, then you know that's it, you must be wrong, or just my view is right. The Buddha was just clear. The first factor of the Eightfold Path, right view, means that defines your basic understanding of what's right, what's wrong, what is important. So there are different definitions of right view in the suttas. The standard one is, of course, some basic understanding of the Four Noble Truths, but also sometimes, for example, just the understanding what's wholesome, what's unwholesome is described as right view. And that is very important, isn't it, as a foundation for all of our action. Because if that is not in place, then however mindful we are, then there's not much good coming out of it, isn't it? Because our actions are not informed by actually a wholesome kind of intention. So right view informs our intention. Second factor in the Eightfold Path is right intention. If you got right view, we have right intention. So, and of course, the Buddha, with advertising mindfulness as a key factor in his Eightfold Path and in his practice, appears again and again, he basically, both with Sati and Sampajanya, he picks up a normal faculty of the mind that we all share and uses it for a spiritual context. Well, of course, there might be different ways that you can choose to say, like, yeah, what makes mindfulness right mindfulness is if your intention is for which you apply mindfulness and Sampajanya is in service of a wholesome action. And more specific, of course, in the Buddha's path, it's and a basic understanding of the Four Noble Truths. It means we apply mindfulness not to rob a bank, no, but to understand better how our mind works, where the suffering comes in, to understand suffering, and to understand how to abandon those attitudes, habits, or actions of the mind, body, speech, and mind that lead to suffering for ourselves. No? So that defines our view, the right view, which defines our intention. And then mindfulness and clear comprehension work within that context. Then I pay attention with this explicit intention in my mind, and then I can use my natural intelligence to process the information that mindfulness gives me to inform me about what I'm interested in, which is suffering and the end of suffering. Anyway, it's quite logical. But so it all depends on the context. So we had the mindfulness and clear comprehension of the cat and also bank robber. You can see, of course, also in principle, this knowing, if you talk really about clear knowing, it's again, like I said yesterday, of mindfulness, it will have perhaps in itself, of course, a tendency of eroding, if you engage with it, eroding the boundaries, limitations that you put on your mindfulness or clear comprehension through your limited interests. No, so in that sense, if you're not interested in waking up and becoming wholesome, then of course mindfulness and clear comprehension is always dangerous. That I think by my original teacher, where some people say, like, okay, the bank robber, once he practices mindfulness and clear comprehension, then he, of course, stops being a bank robber because he has got a clear comprehension. He knows what he's doing. He realizes what he's doing and says, well, this is no good. I have to give this up. But this implies already a certain developed sense of clear comprehension, isn't it? So for the bank robber to stay in his realm of being just a successful bank robber, they will have to make the effort to limit that natural human capacity, you know, for paying attention and for intelligence to just this narrow interest about, you know, getting at the money. You know, once it leaps out of it, it will have the tendency to actually put in question what you're doing, obviously. That if you're intelligent, then we question what we're doing there, isn't it? So just to explain this as in terms of how this is kind of, you know, the technical function of these things. They don't somehow have enlightenment inscribed by them as if by magic, you know, just be mindful and then then everything's going to be all right. It really depends. It is important to have some previous understanding, you know, of how things work and what we are interested in. So that's why it's very important in our practice to be aware of our intentions. No, I mean, we talk sometimes about bare mindfulness. And I think it makes sense in the sense of how, you know, just mindfulness can really bear down your experience very much, you know, cut down on proliferation or just being present, just being attention, not going any further, not judging, being non-judgmental and all this kind of thing. But I think we should remember that as human beings, we never come into any situation completely bare. We always bring our past into the situation, our preconditioning, our interests, our intentions. And it's those interests, our intentions, our conditioning, which very strongly going to filter what we actually pay attention to. No, that proverbial saying, you know, all that the pickpocket sees of a saint is the pockets. No, how I can get the money. It explains basically that, you know, what we're actually able to pick up in a situation and to make use of depends on our preconditioning. You know, so in bare mindfulness is never completely bare. You know, mindfulness is defined by this kind of context. This one sutta that I often like to refer to in the Majjhima Nikaya, the Buddha was talking about the Eightfold Path. He is talking about that every factor of the Eightfold Path has to be developed in conjunction with three of those eight factors. So always have to be present. They're the kind of key, they're essential. Now, here's the quiz. What are those three? No? No volunteers? Okay. Sati, yeah, of course, that's the one that we taught us, no? Is our mindful state. So sati, mindfulness, all the factors of the past have to be developed with mindfulness, because if you're not present, then you're not even on the playing field. You can't know what's going on if you don't pay attention. But then this is the thing, and this is basically what I'm talking about right here. What are the two other factors of the past that always have to come into play, that have to support mindfulness, that work together with mindfulness? So only seven left. So yeah. Wisdom, yeah, it doesn't appear as such, which is a good idea, but doesn't. So I gave you the hint. If you got those eight factors of the past, it's two of those. Renaud?
Thought, concentration, mindfulness?
No, the concentration is not essential.
Somebody, right after.
There you go. Yeah. Eddie says right effort. And the other one I've just told you already. Here somebody says right intention. That's a good guess. Basically, what the Buddha says, right view. But, you know, right intention, right view, of course, they hang directly together. And that basically describes what I was just saying. Any situation, we already come in with a view. We have to recognize that. We don't never approach any kind of moment. It doesn't matter what we do in an unconditioned kind of state. All our past comes with us. We meet it with what we are. And that defines strongly what we're going to make out of it. So for the Buddha, so the important thing is that we enter the situation, of course, with right view. No, and doesn't mean that we already have to be enlightened. No, like even the understanding of the Four Noble Truths as right view, initial right view, as the Buddha talks about, it just means to have an initial understanding that this is relevant. like that there is suffering, there is actually cause of it, and there is an end to it, and there's a path that's worth walking. Now that if you have that kind of understanding, and that's not something we have to make up all the time. You know, once we've got that, you always carry that with us, isn't it? So it's something that our mind brings into a situation when we pay attention. It will define then our intention, what we're interested in about this. So that's the past, basically. You know, the right view is the past that we bring into the present. Mindfulness is what, it's the present, isn't it? That's being present. So this, that view from the past, we process, hopefully intelligently with Sampajanya, the information that mindfulness gives us in the present. And if you do that, then that will inform the effort that we make. That means what we do with the situation. That's right effort, which looks into the future. No? So basically, right view, right mindfulness, right effort is past, present, future. No? Does it make sense? And that's relevant, very relevant for us as a meditator. So as I said, we had the cat, we had the bank robber. I also, just as an illustration, another illustration to really kind of bring it home, some of you have heard also my story again with Satin Sampajanya about Abhinando. Me, before I became a monk, it fits very well, of course, over the New Year's retreat, because many, many years ago, when I was a teenager still, I was celebrating the end of the year, 31st of December, and it was with my girlfriend at home. I was still living with my parents, and my parents had gone somewhere else to celebrate, so they left the flat to us. And we were going to be really cozy, just the two of us, end of the year, and we were doing it very romantically with a fondue. Swiss. See? So it's double appropriate, end of the year, Switzerland. Here we are. So we did a fondue. At that time, I wasn't a vegetarian, I'm afraid, so it wasn't a cheese fondue, but it was just meat, you know, the thing where you stick in the, you know. So we did our fondue, and it all went very well, and it was great. It was a great evening. And then by the end of it, we were clearing up, you know, being good kids. And so, you know, some cleaning, some throwing away, and I wonder, what do I do with the oil? You know, the oil is still hot, so slowly cooling down, and obviously you can't just put it in the garbage bin or something. And I tried to be sensible, so I very, very mindfully, I didn't know yet about Buddhist practice, but very mindfully, I do remember this, very mindfully poured the oil into the toilet, down the toilet bowl, because I was very careful not to spill any of the oil. That would make a mess, isn't it, the hot oil. So I was very mindful and was very pleased with myself, until the next day, the next morning, my parents were back. And my mother was on the telephone with her brother and was telling her about the latest happenings in the neighborhood. we were living in the second floor and we're fine. But in the ground floor, the people, they had the water overflowing from their toilet bowls because the pipework was blocked. And I remember that very well as well. She was sitting in the couch with the telephone. I was kind of standing in front of it. And then my uncle on the phone just said, oh, well, that would just been one of those bloody idiots who just poured the fondue fat. It wasn't oil, it was fat, of course, it down into the toilet. Of course, once it went down, it cooled and it went hard and it blocked the... So I was very mindful. I was really very mindful, I remember that. But my Sampajanya, the clear comprehension, wasn't on target. No, it's not that I think I was a reasonably intelligent kid, but I just didn't have the right information and didn't quite connect. So even though I had basic intelligence, I didn't have the appropriate Sampajanya for the task at hand. No? And that's one way in which the commentaries to the suttas also define Sampajanya in the, I always forget one of them. There are kind of four definitions. And this is just a commentary, so it's not the Buddha speaking, but it defines it in that way. So that when you're doing, you know what you are doing, you know, what is the purpose of your action, you know, you have a clear knowledge about the adequacy, but that what you're doing is actually appropriate for your purpose. And I think the third one is about staying with the object so that you don't lose, actually, you don't get distracted. And then the fourth one is kind of more general. It's about to have a clear comprehension of the three characteristics, which is anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, dissatisfactoriness, and non-self. That makes, of course, this exercise of Satisampajanya a spiritual exercise. So it's not just to to know what you're doing when you're building a cupboard or something, or when you're pouring away, you know, what to do with your fondue when you finish. But that you're paying attention in terms like, is your meditation, what is actually my purpose? Why am I actually meditating? Is what I'm doing actually serving this purpose? Am I with the task? And that kind of wisdom aspect, that I look at it in terms of the Four Noble Truths, here explained as the three characteristics. So I pay attention to what I meant to impermanence, to the dissatisfactoriness and non-self, just as an example. So then Sampajanya together with mindfulness can be the seed for wisdom, to develop. And if you don't have that, we can meditation can just become very mechanical. As I said, there's a natural pressure for, if you just pay attention for long enough, probably something's going to happen in our mind, something interesting. But we can also miss a lot, if you don't actually intelligently process what's actually happening. And it starts with very simple things. If I do anapanasati, mindfulness of breathing, and I just keep falling asleep and then just complain, why do I always fall asleep? Maybe there hasn't been actually an appropriate evaluation of the information that you're paying attention is supposed to give you, like that maybe your meditation object is too refined for your state of mind. It's just as an example that I can give. Like if you have learned anapanasati, like noticing the air flow in your nostrils, and how the air's nice and cool when it comes in and it's warmer when it comes out. And so can you notice it on the upper lip? That's very delicate. It can be sublime, for if your mind is refined enough to actually stay with that, then the idea is, of course, that the refined object helps refine your attention even more down. So that can be a very, very useful technique for approaching excellent, delicate states of samadhi, of collectedness. But if you just meditate at home during a busy kind of work week where you're working 48 hours a week or so, and you come home and you are exhausted and there's the conflicts maybe at work that you had are still reeling in your head, and then you sit down and you're trying to observe the air coming in and out of your nostrils, unless you're very, very proficient, very skilled, it's very likely you're not going to go very far. Either you just got one, two, and then you fall asleep, or the mind just goes to something that's more interesting and more obvious. It's not going to stay with something that we find. So mindfulness, the mindfulness that you've got, will give you that information, isn't it? This is what's happening. And if the intelligence is switched on, then you're supposed to adjust your effort. This is how Sampajanya leads to right effort. You say, well, this is not the right kind of meditation exercise right now. I can pick this up again, maybe when the mind is calmed down and it's nice and in balance. But now I'm just going to have to do something a little bit more coarse. So then you start to ask yourself questions. What could I do actually to wake myself up a bit more? So that's why Ajahn Buddhadasa said, no, this is Sampajanya. That's wisdom in action, applied intelligence in our meditation.